From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The killing of 20 children at the Sandy Hook Elementary School is just the latest. But there are other tragedies that make us wonder why. We should point out that for many, why is an absurd question, at least if you're thinking about it in the cosmic sense. Not everyone believes in an ordered universe. But for those who do believe in a God, or those who are still working it out, why is a big question. Why does God allow suffering and tragedy? Really, it's about the nature of God, and today in the program, we're beginning a series of conversations about just that. We'll begin today with the perspective of two believers, two Mormon scholars, husband and wife Terrell and Fiona Givens. They've written a book that gets at the question. It's called The God Who Weeps. We hope to hear from you as well after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the days after 20 elementary school children were killed in Newtown, Connecticut, the New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd was asking the obvious question, why? So she turned to a family friend, a Catholic priest, Father Chuck O'Malley, and asked him to consider the question and to write a meditation. Father O'Malley's essay began with the hard questions. How can we celebrate the love of a God become flesh when God doesn't seem to do the loving thing? If we believe, he writes, that God is all-powerful and all-knowing, why doesn't he use this knowledge and power for good in the face of evils that touch our lives? And those were the questions that got me thinking. Really, it seems to come down to this. What is the nature of God? Does he or she or it, whichever pronoun works for you, intervene in people's lives? What are the conditions under which God does step in? When does he back off? What's his relationship with humankind? Can we ever know his will? Can we ever account for anything God does? Today in the program, we're beginning a series of conversations that get at the question of why. I should mention we're also going to include non-believers in this conversation, but we're beginning today with two believers, the scholars, husband and wife, Terrell and Fiona Givens. They're with us today to offer a Mormon perspective. They've written a book called The God Who Weeps, How Mormonism Makes Sense of Life. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Terrell Givens is a professor of literature and religion at the University of Richmond in Virginia. He's the author of several books, among them a history of Mormon culture called People of Paradox. Fiona Givens recently retired from directing a high school French language program. She's also worked as a translator and as a lobbyist. Fiona Givens has collaborated with her husband on a number of books, though this is their first co-authorship. And they're joining us today from NPR member station WCVE in Richmond, Virginia. Terrell and Fiona Givens, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thank you, Doug. Lovely to be here.
Well, I guess I wanted to begin in the book. Let me begin with this. You say that we humans are meaning-making machines, complex creatures, you say, who crave. I guess these are two contradictory things. We want wonder and we want clarity. Let's start there, those sort of contradictory notions we all seem to share.
Well, I think one ready-to-hand example of that is how we like magic shows, right? We love to be entertained by great magicians. We love to re-experience that childhood sense of wonder and magic. But at the same time, something eats away at us if we can't figure out exactly how it was done. So we want to demystify, even as we also want to relish the magic and mystery of the universe. Mm.
So you've got – it's interesting. You've got faith on one hand. You've got reason on the other. In the book, you say faith often asks us to – here's how you put it – turn a blind eye to the incongruities and the inconsistencies of belief in the divine. What do you mean by that exactly? What incongruities?
Well, I don't think that any belief system, Mormonism included, provides a full and complete template that we can impose on experience and make sense of everything that happens in our lives or in the world. And so we are always left with some aspects of cognitive dissonance, of incompletion in our attempts to fully grasp the meaning of life and what happens around us. So we assemble the evidence as best we can until we get what seems to be a reasonable, coherent paradigm. But I think that we are always in the process of adjusting, modifying, and trying to improve that paradigm to make better sense of life.
You say that whatever meaning we give to our experiences in lives, you say it must necessarily be a gesture of faith. And I think this is an important sense of kind of a groundwork, I think, for the conversation itself. Kind of this in the book, you sort of describe it as the realm where faith operates. Let's talk about that, a gesture of faith. And as you put it in the book also, it's a choice and it's laden, you say, with moral significance.
Well, moral agency is a, if not the paramount concern in Mormon theology. And it seems to me that we readily understand how physical coercion can deprive us of our liberty. But it seems reasonable to suggest that we can be mentally coerced by an overabundance of evidence, for example. I don't really feel that I am free to choose to believe or not believe in the law of gravity. The evidence is too overwhelming. I'm essentially compelled to believe. So that belief doesn't reflect anything about my moral character, about what my deepest desires and wishes are, about the way that I want to make meaning or find value in life. So I think to fully operate in the moral sphere, the universe has to be constructed in such a way that we find reasonable grounds to affirm our faith in the divine and the goodness of life, but we also can find reasonable grounds to disbelieve in those things so that we are truly free in the fullest sense of the word to choose what it is that we will affirm, what it is that we will exercise faith in.
You know, you often hear in Mormon congregations, in Mormon testimony meetings, for example, "I believe without a shadow of a doubt." Is the person who's saying that, are they getting it wrong in some way?
Not necessarily. I think there has been an unfortunate cultural shift towards the "I know." I think that knowledge has come to supersede belief, actually, in Mormon culture, which is really unfortunate because we have in our scriptures the fact that to some is given to know that Jesus is the Christ and to others it is given to believe on their word. So if a person stands up and says that they know something, I'm not going to argue with that. I think my question would be, are you being authentic by declaring your knowledge, or is this something you know, or is this something you believe? And I feel that we as Mormons, especially, and as Christians generally, in fact, any faith tradition, should be allowed to say, "I believe." But there has to be this play in some things that we feel very strongly to be true, and some things we hope are true because we find them beautiful.
It's interesting you also point out, so we're talking about faith, and now let's bring reason into all of this, because you point out reason also comes up short in terms of accounting for those deeper moments, moments of deep love, moments of anguish, moments of yearning. You talk about in the book that these are the things that are kind of visible to the inner eye alone. So reason, we can't access everything through reason either, I guess.
No, absolutely not. You know, Terry Eagleton is a great Marxist critic in the contemporary age, and he wrote a book just a few years ago in which he pointed out that the Enlightenment project has had almost 200 years to prove its claims that human reason is the solution to everything. And yet it's failed dismally. The world is no happier. People find no more meaning or beauty or value in their lives today than we have at most any other period. He says maybe that means it's time to go back and see what religion has to offer. You could take Darwin as a good example of this. Darwin is typically invoked as somebody who, well, in Dawkins' words, he made atheism intellectually respectable because he answers all the religious questions. But of course he doesn't. He talks about how species evolve, how present forms of life may have arrived at the point they're at. But he can't presume to answer questions like, well, where did the first life originate? Or what gives life its meaning or its value or its beauty? And those are some of the areas where reason clearly comes up short in answering the most important questions of our existence. Mm.
And I think also to add to what Terrell's just said, I mean, there are moments in our lives, are there not, when we look at an incredible sunset or a sunrise and we are stunned and the response to it is emotional, not reasonable. We feel it deep down that there is this great beauty that has been displayed for us, and then immediately we go to, you know, the author behind that, because it is an emotional, sometimes even spiritual response. So there has to be this give and take between reason and faith in order us to be able to make those choices and fashion meaning in our lives that is coherent and hopefully optimistic.
It's interesting, too, because you say in the book that reason is a necessary part of the equation, part of, as you say, any solution to the mystery of life. And I get the sense that you're thinking God wants these questions, that he, you put it this way in the book, that he gave humankind an intellect and he expects it to be used, I guess.
Right. I certainly don't see any moral or spiritual value in the notion, which has prevailed many times in the past, that faith, that reason must disappear to make room for faith. It would take a perverse creator to differentiate us from all other creatures by endowing us with a godlike capacity for reason and then expecting us not to employ it or not to find it a useful tool in making sense of the world he's placed us in. You know, in the Mormon past, there's a wonderful photograph that I think captures perfectly the synthesis that Mormon theology strives to achieve. There's a photograph of Orson Pratt's observatory, and it's this little pathetic adobe hut. And he erects it in the immediate shadow of the rising Salt Lake Temple. And this photograph of the temple and the observatory serves as what I think is a perfectly apt metaphor for Mormonism's insistence that ultimately we should and we can fully reconcile the realms of human reason and the realms of religious faith.
And also, you know, we should be, God gave us a brain. We should be connecting with him through our brain, through our intellect, as well as our faith. You cannot have one without the other. He gave us a brain to ask really important questions. And those are the questions that he wants us to ask, the questions of why. They are very important to him, and it's this expanse, forcing our minds and our hearts to expand to an extent where we can reach the divine and understand those answers that are coming back to us. My conviction is that God does not do small talk. It's actually in those moments of crucibles of affliction, where of tragedy in our lives, that we are actually more open to asking the right questions, which as often or not are as important or if not more important than the answers. A lot of this interaction with the divine is self-revelatory as well as God revealing himself to us.
Hmm. There are a number of propositions, five in fact, that you include in the book that, and I want to work through. We may not get to all of them, but I think clearly the first one that you write about gets at the question of the nature of God. And it's your sense that God is a personal entity, that he's flesh and bone, I guess. And it's easy around here to take for granted certain precepts of Mormon cosmology. So I guess we should explain that Mormons believe that God was once a man, I guess. Terrell Givens and Fiona Givens, am I oversimplifying here?
That Mormons believe that God is flesh and bone, that he may have been as one of us. Yes, that I think that floats around, but that's not the core. I think what struck us both was this brilliant question and answer session that goes off on in an ascension narrative in the Pearl of Great Price in the Book of Enoch, where you have Enoch, who is, you know, a great man. Mormons all know him as the man who actually was able to create utopia, create a Zion, and that it was raised into heaven. But he has this really intriguing conversation with God, and he's raised up to heaven. God is weeping, and it is quite obvious to Enoch that these are not happy tears, and you feel his whole world shifting. This is a paradigm-shifting moment for Enoch, because he asks God three times, "How canst thou weep? How is it possible? Thou art the author of heaven." I've been told in my seminary classes that heaven is a happy place. Therefore, the author of it should surely be a happy person. But these tears are not happy tears. Explain yourself to me because I'm not understanding this. And God does. And he answers and he says, look, these are my creation. I've commanded them to love each other. And this is what they are doing. Wherefore should not the heavens weep, seeing that these shall suffer? And this is the most extraordinary. This is probably the divine, the essential element of the divine for Terrell and myself, is that God chose, rather than to take his library to the Seychelles and read for eternity, to place his love on us. And by choosing to love us, he made himself vulnerable. And that is the most crucial element of our God. The God we worship is that he is a vulnerable God. And from this vulnerability, all of his other divine attributes, we feel flow. But this is core.
So core to God is empathy.
I think the empathy born of vulnerability. Hmm. Absolutely.
You know, vulnerability is such a dicey word, it seems, when you're talking about God, at least in the sense that there are those who would think that that was a step down for an all-knowing, all-seeing, omniscient being, that vulnerability is impossible for a perfect being.
Well, for centuries it has been. The creeds, right to this day, most of them articulate very emphatically belief in a God without body parts or passion,
right,
meaning a God who cannot feel. But, you know, I caught something of the inescapability of this truth a few weeks ago. I have a daughter who was recently married, and she wrote me and she said, Dad, there's one thing that troubles me terribly. She said, since I have fallen so in love and connected my life to this other, I sometimes can't sleep at night for worry that something will happen to him someday. She said, will that go away? And I said, no, that never goes away. That's the price of love. It was Francis Bacon who first said, to love another is to give a hostage to fortune. And more recently, Freud said, we are never so vulnerable as when we love. That is the cost of any meaningful relationship, the risk and vulnerability that our concern for the other entails.
You write about in the book that, of course, this idea of a God who weeps, this is, of course, where you get the title of the book. And you say this motif of a weeping God appears in other ancient traditions, in the Talmud, for example. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, there's one Talmudic tradition that that recasts a verse that we hear sung in the Messiah every Christmas time, comfort ye my people. And it turns out the one rendering of that Isaiah passage is actually comfort me, my people.
And also, if we look in the Old Testament, God asks for his people to build him a sanctuary. And that particular scripture just struck me. And I realized that God was asking his people to build him a sanctuary. For God to speak to his people, to come to earth, must be excruciating on every level. Psychological, emotional, physical, for a being of such beauty and purity and delight to enter our atmosphere. And it's so interesting because you wonder why do people always have conversations with God on mountaintops? And we think because it's, you know, mountains are closer to heaven. No, they're not. They're further away from earth. And so again, you feel this vulnerability. God wishes to be with his people, but he needs a safe place to be able to interact with his people, which is why he asked for a sanctuary to be built. It's for him, not for us.
Fiona Givens and Terrell Givens, they're co-authors of the book, The God Who Weeps, How Mormonism Makes Sense of Life. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're beginning an occasional series of conversations about the nature of God. We're going to build them around the question, why would a loving God, if there is such a being, why would this God allow tragedy and suffering? The murders in Newtown, Connecticut got us thinking about the question. Along the way, we're going to be hearing from non-believers too. But since we're here in Utah, it makes sense to begin with an LDS perspective. The Mormon scholars Terrell and Fiona Givens are with us today. We're talking about their book, which gets at the question. The book is called The God Who Weeps, How Mormonism Makes Sense of Life. And again, you can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So the image we're getting here, of course, is that the God that you believe in is a deeply personal God, a vulnerable God, a God who weeps for humankind. And then you ask this question in the book that if God exists, does he deserve our worship? And I wanted to ask you about this. What do you mean? Because I guess the question here is God this arbitrary and indifferent figure, or is God merciful and then engaged, directly engaged with humankind, which raises questions then about God's will and about how prayer works, which I want to get to. But you explain, for example, that Augustine believed in a God who had arbitrarily foreordained countless millions, maybe even billions, to damnation. But he thought that it would be, you know, slanderous or, I guess, blasphemous to raise questions about this. So to the question that you write about, does he deserve our worship? Talk about that, if you would.
Well, I think clearly the God of Augustine does not. Mm-hmm. You know, one could say, well, St. Augustine's conception of God is human and incomplete, and therefore he's content to acknowledge the impossibility of understanding and appreciating God's perspective on justice. And I think, well, that's not exactly biblical, because what happens after Adam and Eve partake of the fruit in the garden, according to Genesis, is God says they have become as one of us. So the implication there seems to be that they have entered into the same moral or conceptual universe that God inhabits. So it would be perverse for God to endow us with the light of Christ or conscience or moral sensibility on the one hand, and on the other, expect that we should blithely accept a version of deity that has him as capricious, even sadistic, in consigning, as you said, to hell untold billions of people who die in ignorance or before the possibility of embracing the gospel and be baptized comes their way. I simply don't feel that there's any basis to feel that that is a God who would be worthy of our worship.
He would also be a colossal failure as a God if his design is to ensure that his children return to him, as Mormons believe he does, and that we are all here as part of this great plan to eventually return to the divine presence. Then, you know, having all of these people in hell, he's made a mistake somewhere. The plan was faulty to begin with. Mm. And we don't actually believe that he is a colossal failure as a God. There's something really important, as Terrell said, that happened in that Garden of Eden story. And I think Mormons champion this, and I think is absolutely brilliant. I mean, Eve is not a colossal failure either. I mean, what Adam and Eve experienced was a theoretical type of knowledge, not experiential. But in order for us to develop those attributes of the divine, empathy, compassion, forgiveness, mercy, love, we have to have an experiential knowledge. So when we're talking about the, you know, decision to eat of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, Eve recognizes that the fruit is good, that it is beautiful, and that it will make her wise. And so she has this decision to make. And most decisions are not the easy decisions of between good and evil, but between good and good. So the decision for her is, does she stay in the safety and the security that the garden offers her? Or does she eat of this fruit and gain these other things, a greater understanding of what it is to be good, what the beautiful entails? Mm. And what is wisdom? But it can only be obtained at the price of painful lived experience. It is only by experience tragedy in our lives that we develop the empathy to be able to comfort those who stand in need of comfort and mourn with those who mourn.
Maybe this is an historical question, but you write about how for centuries there was this sentiment of divine tyranny. You know, we thought that God would do what God would in a capricious way, and you just had to take it. Was there a turning point? I love how you mention Huckleberry Finn. I'm guessing Twain wasn't the turning point necessarily, but you talk about how Huck is faced with this chance to help his friend, the escaped slave Jim. Then to turn him in would have been the so-called Christian thing.
Right.
But Huck defies God. He chooses damnation, doesn't turn him in. Is that reflecting the sentiment that was changing, that people realized that God had to sort of live up to some of our sense of value to be worthy of worship?
I mean, I think that's an excellent question. And I think Mark Twain is absolutely brilliant. I think he understood. I'm not sure that it was God that Huckleberry Finn was rejecting. It was certainly this type of religion that promulgated this God, this Jonathan Edwards God, who just couldn't wait to burn us all in hell. I mean, and again, it goes back to your question of, you know, what God do we worship? Well, not all gods are deserving of worship, we don't think. And I think this is where reason comes in as well, as empathy. Yes, it would have been the, in those days, so-called legal Christian thing to do. But Huck's heart and mind tell him it is wrong. It is wrong.
There's a huge revolution in religious sentiment in the 19th century, of which Twain is representative. But I mean, you see the collapse of much of the Calvinist posture. You see the growth of much milder, gentler versions of deity, a de-emphasis on the principle of original sin and original guilt. You know, I made a comment at a religious conference last year that in 1830, when Joseph has his reveals this vision of Enoch, that this is revolutionary to say that not only does God feel, but he weeps literally over us. Mm-hmm. And one theologian objected and said, oh, lots of people were saying that in the 19th century. And I said, are you familiar with your own creeds? And I said, the church you represent officially espouses as its creed a God without body parts or passions, and still does. And he looked a little chagrined and he said, well, nobody really pays attention to those creeds. So that may be, but the fact is that there is widespread dissatisfaction with that model of God. And you see it both in a turning toward a passable deity, which is now commonplace in theology, and you see it at the level of people like Mark Twain and Dostoevsky, whose great character Ivan in the Brothers Karamazov says, I don't disbelieve in God, I just reject the God of conventional Christianity.
You know, this question, you raise this question in the book, can God do what he wants? Or as you put it, is God hostage in some way to his limitless love? I think that's an interesting question. Is God bound in some way, I guess?
Well, I think he is. I think he chooses to be bound in the same way a parent can choose to assume the obligations of parenthood once he has a child. But there are several elements of Mormon theology that give a slightly different cast to this whole problem of theodicy. Mm-hmm. One of the unique features of Mormon cosmology is the belief that much of the world and its conditions, the physical and moral laws of the universe, are given. God is not the author of all that exists. And God himself operates in harmony with those laws. Even God can't make 2 plus 2 equal 5. So when we ask why, for example, does God not intervene? Why does he not stop tragedy? Notice that we're always asking why he doesn't intervene, why he doesn't violate a natural law or a natural process. And I think one answer is implicit in the way we always phrase the question. And that is that God is constrained by his commitment to such principles as moral agency, the moral freedom of human beings to hurt each other, and by the natural laws of the universe as they operate.
Mm.
And I think also in addition to this, I think oftentimes, you know, we'll ask, why did God not stop the tsunami? Why did God not stop this tragedy? But we're never aware of the things that he actually is empowered to stop, because we never see them happening. So we don't see the miracles that he actually does invoke in our behalf. And the other thing too is that we tend to use, in my mind, God as a scapegoat for our own responsibility. I mean, we are here on earth. We are brothers and sisters. We believe that we are. It is our responsibility to each other then when these tragedies happen, rather than, you know, using God as a scapegoat and then exempting ourselves from any responsibility or any action, that it really is our responsibility to act and to help each other. When Christ said in the New Testament, the poor you will have with you always, that was an analogy for you are going to have suffering. It is the nature of the university. How are you going to respond to that? It's not just poverty. It is grief. It is loss. You know, in a year from now, are we going to be sending letters to those families at Sandy Hook saying, we remember, we are still praying for you, for your loss, because this is something these people will never, from which they will never recover. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, once the press has left and the media has left, where is our responsibility? Do we then leave? And so I think this is a call to us as human beings to be much more involved in each other's tragedies by being empathic, by trying to carry the burden or help with the burden that people leave. God is giving us an opportunity, I think, for us to show the divine in ourselves.
It raises the question, though, what is the purpose, the useful purpose of prayer? I guess on one hand, you could say it's just an expression of gratitude, or it's an acknowledgement of God or something big. But then, of course, there are those who see it, and those within Mormonism who see prayer as quite functional. There's a modern Mormon scripture from a book that some may be familiar with, The Doctrine and Covenants, that says, I, the Lord, am bound when ye do what I say. But when ye do not what I say, ye have no promise. That the Lord is bound when you do certain things to behave a certain way. And I want to play a moment from a speech by a Mormon general authority named Devin Cornish. This comes from LDS General Conference. This was October of 2011. And Elder Cornish is telling the story about being in medical school in Boston. And he explains how he had worked these long hours and he would bike back and forth to his home where he had a wife and he had four young children. And in the story that he talks about riding home and that he needed to find some time and some energy for his family. He was really exhausted. And he was hungry also. And he talks about how this route home would take him past this fried chicken shop. Let me play this moment because I want to talk about it.
I knew they were running a sale on thighs or drumsticks for 29 cents each. But when I checked my wallet, all I had was one nickel. As I rode along, I told the Lord my situation and asked if, in his mercy, he could let me find a quarter on the side of the road. I told him that I didn't need this as a sign, but that I would be really grateful if he felt to grant me this kind of blessing. I began watching the ground more intently, but saw nothing. Trying to maintain a faith-filled but submissive attitude as I rode, I approached the store. Then, almost exactly across the street from the chicken place, I saw a quarter on the ground. With gratitude and relief, I picked it up, bought the chicken, savored every morsel, and rode happily home. In his mercy, the God of heaven, the creator and ruler of all things everywhere, had heard a prayer about a very minor thing.
Now, some will see this. It's interesting the way the crowd is reacting, kind of laughing about it. But Elder Cornish seems quite serious about the fact that he made this prayer to God to help him find a quarter. And I have to say, with all respect, it may seem kind of a vulgar request if you think about it in the perspective of a father and mother praying for the health of their children as they're heading to elementary school, if you know what I mean. Yeah. Help me understand that. Why would God care about helping a man find a quarter on the ground?
Well, I think there are several issues that are intersecting here. You know, many years ago, we were driving back from a weekend trip to Chapel Hill, and we were on the road, been on the road a while, and suddenly I hear this whimpering from the back seat, and I turn around to see what it is, and it's my 5-year-old son, and he's whimpering because we have forgotten his favorite little 99-cent car back at home. And I said, well, I'm not going to turn around and drive 50 miles just for a 99-cent car. And he didn't say anything, but he continued to cry softly. And then the thought quickly occurred to me, what is more important in the mind and life of a five-year-old child than his favorite car? So we turned around and went back and got it. And I think that may be one of the points that Eld Cornish was trying to make, was that not that this 25 cents was significant in the grand scheme of things, but at that moment, if it was terribly important to him, then it was important to God. Now, I think the reason why people were laughing, I think it was nervous laughter.
Yeah.
Because we realize there is something incongruous in a God who attends upon a need for 25 cents but doesn't answer the cries of the rape victim in the room next to us that
right.
we can't hear because the TV is too loud.
That is the question. That's right.
And to that, I don't have a ready answer. All I know is that I believe the calculus of heavenly intervention is far too complex for us to ever be able to predict how and when that intervention will occur.
Mm.
I think God has to factor in human agency. I think he has to factor in receptivity to his spirit. He has to factor in larger causes and issues and experiences. And there's just an intersection of too many things happening for us to be able to answer that question fully. I just bow in humility before the wonder and the terror of that discrepancy.
So are you saying we can never account for or predict anything God ever does?
Well, I think we're presumptuous to think that we can pronounce a final verdict on such issues, although we may feel that we have a personal intimation of the Spirit that gives us an awareness of how his hand operates. But Fiona has,
well,
I think she wants to make a point.
I think in this story, this conference address that you just played for us, there were a couple of things. One, he didn't expect it to happen. It was just, this would be lovely if it did happen. So he's conceding to God. He's not actually asking for it. It would just make a difference in his life. And it did happen. And it did make a difference in his life. And the difference was God is intimately associated with us and connected with us. And it's these little things. They seem so minuscule in comparison to the greater tragedies and the greater moments of our lives. But it is those little things that help us understand that actually God is listening and he is very intimately connected, so that when those huge tragedies happen, that we already have this connection from the nickel, the 25 cents, the matchbox, that God is aware of us and our situations, so that when that tragedy happens, as it did happen to a very dear friend of ours, those of us who are involved in the tragedy are sometimes the only ones who can see God's hands work, because we have a dear friend who was raped in exactly those circumstances last week. And then to watch the people around her respond to it, especially the men, because, you know, you're thinking, oh my gosh, this is just absolutely devastating. Mm. But who quickly came to give her a blessing, who protected her, who were around her, and that everybody said the right thing at the right time and did the right thing. No, it was not prevented. But the response of the people to the tragedy, unless you were intimately connected with it, you would not know. And it is those intimate connections that we often fail to realize as outsiders to a tragedy. Very quick to place blame, but we are not intimately involved in it most of the time. So we do not see the hand of God moving quietly and gently in the tragedy.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let me take a call or two. Chase has been waiting in Salt Lake. Chase, welcome.
Hi, Doug.
Hi.
Oh, this is a wonderful program. And I just want you to give the Gibbons a hug for me. I don't know how I heard about his book, their book exactly, but I read it 3 or 4 months ago, and it just was a breath of fresh air, answering so many things, but the fundamental question of original sin and the fundamental question of how can a loving God allow all this tragedy to occur. And I won't repeat all you've been saying, but it's so powerful to realize that we are privileged to be in an earth where we are not guaranteed sweetness and happiness all the time. We have to make our contribution to it. Just two comments. I read, after reading the Gibbons' wonderful book, I was drawn back to a book written in the 19th century by William James. Everyone's heard about it, and as far as I know, no one's read it lately, The Varieties of Religious Experience. And I got to know the history of Mr. James when I was working at Harvard. He was dead, of course, but he was still a famous figure. And I started the book thinking, well, this will be a scientist, a academic, talking on a very cranial way about God and about religious experience. And it was quite the opposite. James was talking about all the moments of ascendancy, all the moments of reaching out for God in any way in which you find it, our religious experience. And he was very generous in acknowledging all those different ways. Well, the other man that I would bring to bear is Henry Eyring, who was the father of our Henry Eyring here in Salt Lake in the presidency. Henry Eyring was the founder of psychology, and he used to meet with some of us. We were young students, and he was still old there. And he would just look at us and say, there is no conflict between truth. All ideas can be placed against each other, and solutions can be found. And it was a wonderful combination of saying what God has allowed us to do. Finally, what greater memory will your son have than you went 40 miles back to get his toy truck? You did a lot of things. You bought food for him. You got clothes for him. You sent him to school. Many more profound things, which he could take for granted because all kids get that. But he had a daddy that would go 40 miles back to pick up his thing that will be precious in that kid's life, the rest of it. Thank you for the program, Doug, and thank you, the authors, please, for a wonderful, wonderful book.
I get, some of us recognize that as Chase Peterson. Chase, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Chase. Lovely things to say.
Thank you for what you've done.
Thank you.
Terrell Givens, Fiona Givens are with us. Their book is called The God Who Weeps, How Mormonism Makes Sense of Life, and we need to take another brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Terrell Givens and Fiona Givens. We're talking about their book, The God Who Weeps, How Mormonism Makes Sense of Life. You can join us, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's take another phone call. David is with us in Logan. David, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
Oh, that's okay. Thank you very much. A quick question for the Givens is, as an atheist trying to understand the Mormon God, it seems obvious that he intervenes sometimes and not at others. And as I think of the countless 10-year-old little girls that are abducted and sold in the sex slave trade, and they're enslaved, they die of an STD. Obviously, God decides not to intervene in most of those cases. And if you, as devout Mormons, or your church president as a prophet, if you can't explain the Mormon God and when, where, and why he intervenes, who can?
Well, I think God can. I don't think you throw a light away because it doesn't illuminate every corner of darkness. I don't think any religion has ever made a claim, and I know Mormonism certainly hasn't, to be able to answer every perplexing question. But
I
do
part
believe
of God's personality as to when he intervenes, just like you would, just like anybody else you know in your life.
I'm disagreeing with your characterization of the problem. I don't think it's a matter of God choosing to intervene or not to intervene. I see a pattern in the New Testament experiences of Jesus where he comes back from some areas of preaching and we're told he could do no miracle there because of the people's unbelief. So I believe that God is bound not by his own whimsy, but by a myriad of factors that involve the agency and freedom and interactions and choices of a host of other people. I don't know, but maybe Elder Cornish found that quarter because he was particularly sensitive in listening to the Spirit. And maybe that girl was raped because nobody in the next room was paying attention to the things they should have been paying attention to. As Fiona has said, I think it's an error to use God as a scapegoat for every disappointment or tragedy that we see unfolding in life. I simply wouldn't presume to lay that blame at the feet of a God.
And I think also the Mormon belief of God is that he is not omnipotent. That actually is not what most Christians believe. We believe that he is empowered by our faith. And also, the ruling paradigm in our universe is agency. And if God intervenes arbitrarily here and there, then it is at necessarily at the cost of human agency, which cannot be violated. So as Terrell said, it's difficult for us to know. We don't have a panoramic vision of our universe. We do not see everything that is going on in it. And we don't see the hand of God moving even in those areas of tragedy and in those lives. We simply are incapable of seeing it. We do not have the eyes to see. But we do know that agency is paramount, which means that we have been given the power to do absolutely dreadful things to each other. And we've also been given the power to do absolutely sublimely beautiful things to each other. What are we going to choose to do? We can either complain about God or we can get into the muck and the mire and try to do something to save each other. I think that the responsibility is with us. If we're concerned about the slave trade, then we need to get involved. We need to make sure that we are passing laws, that things are happening. It is our responsibility. These are our people. And God has given us, I think, an opportunity to live here on the earth to help each other. And so I would say that this is what we are here to do.
Do you think you understand David's frustration? I mean, I'm sure you hear it from time to time.
But absolutely.
I mean, the sense of absolutely. Frustration that, look, you guys need to explain this. You need to. There's got to be some sort of pattern here that will guarantee some kind of result. You've got to be able to explain. I mean, there is a deep sense of frustration. You hear it a lot, I think, in these circumstances.
Oh, absolutely. But unfortunately, there is no pattern. There is no guidebook. There is no handbook. That is the, you know, it's the vicissitudes of life. We don't expect it. Every day I am grateful that I am alive and I know that, you know, one slight thing and I'm not here anymore, or my children. It's life is capricious. And I think that's really hard for us to understand as human beings or to accept, because we want patterns. And I think we can see them, but we need to choose to see them. I can see God's hand working in my life through myriad tragedies and difficult times, but I have to be looking for them in order to see them. And I found that God works gently, But I also realize that if there is a God, there has to be evil. And I find that evil, it works with great exposure to himself. This is what I do. But God's hand is seldom seen. You have to look for it. It really requires your intellect, your faith, and your desire to believe that there is actually a divine presence out there who loves. And this is what is so extraordinary, I think, about Mormon belief, is that we actually do believe in a God who has sacrificed himself for his creation rather than the other way around. And this is all part and parcel of it. He's wrapped up in all the vicissitudes of life, as we are.
Doug, let me just go back to the Brothers Karamazov, because I find that tremendous story gives us another way of thinking about the question that your caller asked. In that story, we find Ivan is an agnostic, and his brother Alyosha is a devout young acolyte entering the priesthood. And Ivan torments him with stories of horrific suffering imposed upon children who have been brutalized by sadistic parents or overseers or masters. And after sketching these harrowing scenes of innocent children suffering, which he actually took from contemporary news accounts, he asks the young priest to be, Alyosha, would you be willing to organize a universe and fill it with humanity if it depended on the suffering of just one innocent child beating her breast with her little fists in an outhouse where she's been tortured and consigned? And Alyosha says no. So the problem isn't that we don't understand the why. Often the problem is that we don't like the only answers available, that the cost is too high. It's not that we don't understand why God would allow these things to happen. That's pretty clear to understand in general terms, because we do these things to each other. We chose them, not God. But the complaint, I think, is more often, well, I just refuse to accept a God who's willing to create a world and people it subject to those horrors. Mm. And to that, I can only say, I can't blame you
Yeah.
any more than I can blame Yvonne.
Yeah. We don't have a lot of time for this, so maybe it's too much to get into. But in the book, you write about how you say this. You say, for those less meritorious or those who insist on turning away from the lessons of experience, Mormonism holds the ultimate promise. And you write this: there is no eternal damnation because any immortal being foolish enough to think he or she can choose that during this life, or who had too easy a journey to learn much, will have an eternity of makeup classes after death. Now, there's one gentleman, his name escapes me, forgive me, who takes exception with that. He says, of course Mormons believe in a final judgment, and that there will be a moment when there's no more progression and some will be relegated to outer darkness. How do you respond to that idea? Because this is an important concept in the book, this idea that there is progression, and there always will be, I guess.
Well, I think so. The question isn't an open and shut question. In fact, I have a copy of a statement that the First Presidency issued in answer to the question, will there be progression from kingdom to kingdom? And their answer was, we don't know. But what I find highly ironic is that Joseph Smith himself clearly favored an idea of universalism, that eventually everybody would make it. Even the sons of perdition, he said kind of tantalizingly, we don't know what their fate is going to be. Leaving even that door open. Hiram Smith interpreted the vision section 76 as reflecting a version of eternal progress through those kingdoms. That was how James Talmage understood the principle. That was how B.H. Roberts understood the principle. That was how J. Reuben Clark understood the principle. It's only in the 1970s that we have fairly influential figures like Bruce McConkie shutting down that possibility. So I certainly don't think it's the case that Mormonism officially declares that there will ever be an end to anybody's progress. I don't read Mormonism that way.
It's really interesting that Joseph Smith himself said, you know, that God will ferret out every soul. And it goes back to this whole idea of God wishes to save everybody, to have everybody return to him. Then, you know, this idea of universalism, of God having that capacity to be able to do so, I think resonates very, very strongly. And we need to understand that we're on an uneven playing field. When we make choices, we are never making choices in the clear clarity of day. I mean, there are hormones, genetics, environment, so many other things that obfuscate our view. And so to be judged on the choices that we make in all of the white smoke in which we are surrounded and consumed, that would be no fair judgment at all. And so I think it's a much more optimistic view that, you know, eventually we will be able to work through all of those things and our heart continues to lead us and guide us to the true, the beautiful, and the wise, which is what Eve sought in the first place. And so, and that's the wonderful thing, is that not only do we believe in pre-existence, but we believe that this life is important for us to continue, and in the next life we will continue to progress and learn and grow to become more like our God.
Well, that music was the clue that we're out of time. Terrell Givens and Fiona Givens. The book is called The God Who Weeps, How Mormonism Makes Sense of Life. They joined us today from NPR member station WCVE in Richmond, Virginia. Thank you very much both for being with us.
Our pleasure. Thank you so much, Doug.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.